The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a, quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode. Find us on Instagram and at alittlebitculty.com. Welcome back, everybody. Here's part two of our chat with Sarah Landry, who helped build a YouTube kingdom for a shady guru and is now whistleblowing her little heart out.
See our full show notes for more of the backstory, or if you haven't heard part one, back on up and check it out first. And just a word of warning.
This episode covers sexual assault, child abuse, and all kinds of potentially triggering stuff. Please listen carefully and take good care of yourself. Here's part two with Sarah Landry. So thanks for explaining what was good. I think we got it. I feel it. I'm with you. When did it go bad? And what were the red flags along the way that you missed that you now know were there?
It started to go bad the day I physically moved into the Audinam and surrendered as an Audinavasi, so a resident of that Audinam. When you're there as a program participant or a visitor or a casual devotee, they put up this facade. I like to call it the Potemkin village that he puts up, where you walk in and you only see like the clean fronts of the buildings, the landscaped gardens, the good stuff. But when you actually go behind the scenes, none of it is real. Even the buildings aren't real buildings. They're just stones that people threw together and slapped a steel roof on. Like, nothing in his audinam is real. And the persona he puts up during the satsang discourse, he would say, like, the scent of Advaita is friendliness, which the way you can tell whether or not somebody is in a space of oneness is that they'll be friendly. But you go into a meeting where he's talking to his Adinavasis and he'll say, friendliness is Advaita, that's for the public, but here ferociousness is Advaita. And you can tell somebody's integrated by how much they will blast you if you have incompletions. And so everyone was actively encouraged to yell at everybody else if you saw somebody else doing something that you perceived as being out of alignment with his instructions. So an example of that, he would tell me to make 3 YouTube videos a day and 3 Facebook Lives a day. And if anybody caught me doing something like sipping some water or anything, having a conversation with somebody, if I hadn't yet met that goal, they were supposed to yell at me and vice versa. So there was a very toxic interrelation between all of us where you have to be responsible for everyone around you. And if anybody around you is failing to live up to his instructions, then it's your failure. You're supposed to make them succeed. And he divided up the Audinam into teams, and each team had a different responsibility. So the temple team did all of the sacred rituals, and the Gurukul team taught the kids. the welcome center team, you know, greeted guests and served them coffee and tea. There were, I think, 25 teams when I joined. And the first red flag that I ignored was that when Nityananda would call team leads to give them instructions, there was nothing at all about meditation or enlightenment. And I had gone in thinking this whole little society exists to give people an experience of the inner space or the connection to the divine. But instead, he would focus on numbers. How many people did your team bring in? How many views did this latest video get? How many people have paid in advance for the program? How much donation money did you collect? So it was all geared towards bringing in new people and raising money. And another red flag that I kind of brushed past was that Ranjita, so the same South Indian actress in the sex tape, she was always with him. She was the only one in the cult who didn't have either a bed in the dorm or a room with a roommate. She slept in his bedroom with him. And they told us that they've both gone beyond sleep and that she's his administrative head. She's like his personal secretary. And so they're working 24/7. But if I hadn't been in like a sleep deprived, brainwashed state, I'm sure I would have figured out, no, they're just acting like a couple.
Right. Keith had one of those too.
Two or three of those.
Well, I had multiple of them, but one main one that was with him all the time.
We just didn't think the teenagers were the ones.
Yeah.
So Ranjita, I like to call her the Ghislaine Maxwell to his Epstein, because she was his right-hand woman. Everybody in every department reported to her with our deliverables and our work for the day. If anybody was out of line, we had to report it to Ranjita. And the international Sangha had to do the same thing. So all the temple heads all around the world would go to her for permission to do things like something little, like, can we buy new clothes for the deity, up to something big, like, can we host a program on the weekend? She would either say yes or no. It was up to her.
Do you notice that all these male abusers have a female sidekick that's aiding and abetting?
Yes.
It's nuts.
Exactly.
It must extend them credibility, or it's just...
Yeah, like he uses their natural nurturing, like female sort of essence to like for his benefit.
She was not nurturing though. No. She was terrible to all of us. And I think that what Nitti did with Ranjita is that he had to make somebody the bad guy because he wanted everyone to be devoted to him, worship him, love him, believe in him. So if he wanted to yell at somebody or tell them that they're a piece of shit or that they're not accomplishing their task, he would do that through Ranjita. And then if people said, Swamiji, I feel incomplete, she's bullying me, she's blasting me, she slapped me, she yelled at me, she told me to get lost, he would say, I'm so sorry, dear, I'll talk with her. And then he would tell her to apologize.
He triangulated.
And she wasn't the only one. So she was like his first wife. And then he had all his other concubines. And he called that his SM team, which is incredibly narcissistic. SM stood for the Sanskrit word Sachalamurti, which means the moving deity. So he was like claiming to be like the living god who walks and talks, and his SM team would prepare his food, feed him, clean his room, do all that kind of stuff.
And give him blowjobs.
And if he had a crush on a guy or a girl, because he was bisexual that way, the SM team would try to normalize that abuse and say, you know what, this is what we do. He doesn't have lust, but the physical body needs to release this energy. Helps him stay grounded. It helps him remain alive in his physical form. And you're blessed. He felt that your vibration is high enough that you can do this. And so the SM team, led by Ranjita, would train other victims to serve him. Like when I blew the whistle, I knew that he was doing this to men and women. It's only in the past year or so that I found out he was also doing this with kids. And that's what makes it extremely maddening. Like I remember watching The Vow and hearing about like the 12-year-old who Keith raped and thinking, well, at least Nitti didn't go that far. At least his victims were adults. But now I know he did. He did do that with kids as young as 12 that we know of.
How did you find out?
Jesus fuck.
One of my friends who escaped the cult told me that one of his first children victims, who were among the first three students of his Gurukul, had confided in her and said, the reason I asked my parents to pull me out was that he did this to two of us. So two of the first three kids got abused like that. One of the girls who is being trafficked right now, one of her friends told me that when she was still there, the two of them were working really closely together as leads among the Gurukul students. So he would make the older kids take care of the younger kids. And the girl I spoke to was one of the older kids. And she told me that there was a time one of her friends left her cell phone on the table where they were sitting and got up to go to the bathroom. And for some reason, this girl picked up her phone and saw that it was open to the Facebook Messenger messages. And one of the groups that this girl, who was 15 at the time, was a part of it, the Facebook chat group, was called the Suck and Fuck Club, the Nityananda Suck and Fuck Club. And so this girl opened that stream of messages. There were a couple of kids in it. And these 15-year-old girls were sending nude selfies into it. And Nitya was putting heart emojis on those and asking them, what will you do to me when I bring you to my room? And they were, yeah, just describing in detail what they would do to him.
Wow.
And so that's how we know about the older girls, the older but still, I would say, like 15 to 18-year-olds. And then once a kid turned 18, and we assume that there was a male equivalent of that club from things some of the boys have spoken about. As soon as a kid turned 18, if he found that kid attractive, he would bring them onto his SM team. And it was a beauty pageant, whichever kids he thought looked the best. Ugh. I remember one personal experience. I was sitting in the main hall and I saw two 17-year-olds and one 16-year-old girl went backstage to his green room. And his green room was like luxury. It was the only place in the hall with air conditioning. Like he had the best luxury stuff. So I saw three girls go back there. And then one of them came out while the other two were still there. And the girl who came out had this look on her face. She wasn't crying, but she looked really disturbed. And I asked her what was wrong. And she said, Ma Surupa Priya, can you please get me body wax? I asked her what she meant by body wax and said, do you mean makeup? Like, what do you mean? And she said, no, Swamiji told me all of his princesses have to present themselves as princesses, so we can't have any body hair. And I told her, we can go to the place where they provide supplies for Adinavasis. Like, there was a little storehouse we could go to with, like, toothbrushes, toothpaste, shavers, shaving cream. And she said, no, it's Guru Vak for me not to shave. I have to wax. And that was a big red flag. That girl was 17. And she's now one of the missing girls.
What was your final wake up? How did you get out?
My final wake up, there were two incidents that happened when I was sent to Toronto. After he fled India, like he told all of us that he was in danger, that there were people trying to kill him and that he was no longer safe in India. And that's how he explained to us that he fled his rape case. You know, it was about to go into trial phase and he left the country.
With a fake passport, right?
Fake passport. Yeah, he had an expired passport. He has lots of multimillionaire followers. So they've bankrolled this whole escape.
That's what I was going to ask too, is who's supporting him?
I don't necessarily want to name them because I don't want to get sued. One of his close followers is one of the executives at Facebook. And I think that's why his child porn through Facebook Messenger has gone unprosecuted. He has a guy in India who's a billionaire, who's one of his close devotees from Bangalore. He's got people who are corporate lawyers for Google, who are his close inner circle people. They know where he is. I don't know where he is, but they know where he's hiding because they go see him. So I think all of those people are responsible for maintaining his hideout. I was sent to Toronto and I was told, get Nityananda political asylum, reach out to Trudeau, make make connections with the Canadian government. And I laughed too. And I said, well, don't send me to Toronto, send me to Ottawa if you want me to make connections with the national government. And they said, no, Ma, we don't have any devotees in Ottawa. You need to go to Toronto and stay in the ashram house there, which was so stupid. Like, if you want me to meet with Canadian politicians, send me to Canada's capital. I think they didn't know. I think they thought Toronto was the capital. So in some ways, they're evil geniuses. And in other ways, they're stupid idiots.
Yeah.
It was such a confusing process to try to navigate a reality where you're getting instructions from people dumber than you.
We're very familiar with that.
We're also familiar with that.
So in Toronto, there were two kids. Like, there was a 13-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl who had her 13th birthday during the month when we were there. And one night, those kids told me that they were scared to go back to Bididi, where the Audinam is. And I asked them why they didn't want to go back. Like, isn't that better than being stuck here in Toronto? You're the only two kids. Boys and girls aren't allowed to talk to each other. So there's two kids, one boy, one girl. They were so isolated. And I said, don't you miss your friends? Don't you miss your teachers? Don't you miss your parents? Their parents all lived in the Audinam. And the little girl just started to cry. And she said, no, Ma, I'm scared to go back because of the December 31st incident. That could happen again. And I asked her, what was the December 31st incident? And then she kind of like shut down and withdrew. And she looked over at the boy and he was just nodding, like looking down, really, really silent. I could see his eyes teared up. And there was another lady there with me, Balananda, who she's a retired school principal. She has a doctorate of psychology. So she's also one of his top American followers. And we kind of, through eye contact, we communicated to just don't react, listen to what the kids say, because I knew that if I said, wait, what? What happened? What happened? I knew they would withdraw and not want to say anything. So I just kind of stroked her head and said, you can tell us what happened. Don't worry. I'm a Gurukul Acharya, so I have the approval to talk to kids. And then she told me that on the morning of December 31st, 2017, the kids were woken up by the head of the Gurukul, Madhvait, storming into their dorm and dragging them out of bed, out of their bunk beds, and telling them that they were the reason Nityananda's program failed. So this was happening towards the end of a $15,000 program called Mahasadashivoham. There were about 1,000 participants who had paid for this program. At the beginning of the program, Nityananda had promised whoever comes here will manifest third eye powers, that they'll be able to see through their third eye blindfolded, remote vision, telepathy, telekinesis. Like, he promised all kinds of powers. And people were starting to give the feedback that nothing was happening. They weren't feeling it. They weren't getting these powers. They're blindfolded. They don't see anything. So Madhvait goes into the Gurukul. There's about 100 kids, 50 girls, 50-ish boys. And she told them, the program is a failure and it's your fault. Swamiji gave the energy, but you are not entangling with the participants. And therefore, they are not getting these powers. So he was using a lot of scientific terminology like mirror neurons and entanglement. And he had told these kids, they have to manifest the powers and then go into entanglement with the program participants to make them catch those powers. Kind of like a 100th monkey thing, but for fake third eye powers. So Madhvait told these kids, you are so insensitive, you're so incomplete, you're so disconnected from Swamiji that you will never be able to feel his pain at your failure unless it's physical. And with a stick, she beat her own sons because two of her sons were in the school really, really horrifically. Like, she broke one of the kids' knuckles in front of the other kids and said, in India, it's legal for a mother to discipline her child physically, but it's illegal for an adult to beat other kids. So she made them beat each other. And I've heard this from like 10 different survivors now who were kids. And so she first made one little girl beat all the girls. And she picked that girl based on, she had had a video go viral on YouTube where she demonstrates the third eye reading. So she said, you're the only girl who's integrated, beat the rest of them so that they can break their patterns and become integrated. And then she did the same. She appointed one boy to beat all the boys. The girl who was beating the other girls was crying, saying, I don't want to do this. I don't want to hurt my friends. And the boy who was beating the other boys was a 17-year-old, forced to beat kids as young as like 7. So he was crying, saying, I don't want to do this. So then Madhvait made all the kids beat each other. And I looked at the little boy and said, is what she's telling me, like, does that match your experience? And he said, it's worse than what she's telling you. So the kids were super traumatized. I asked, why did none of us know? Like, how come only the Gurukul department knew that this had gone on? How did I not see this? And the kids told me that at the bottom of the 1,000-bed dorm where Adinavasis stayed, there was a floor that they called Nivas, which is where the kids slept. And she said, Ma, don't you remember there was a week when the kids were locked in Nevis to do completion? And I do remember this happened, like for a week after December 31st, that first week of January, the kids didn't leave their dorm. And there was like a big chicken wire fence that was locked at all of the openings. And there were curtains drawn on the inside so we couldn't see in to where the kids were. I remember there was a day during that week when I had gone into the dorm to get something from a friend of mine who slept there. And I remember a little kid's hand like sticking out through that gate, holding an empty water bottle saying, who's out there? Can you please get us water? Because the adults just left them for the day. So she said they were locked up so that nobody would see the bruises, the welts, the black eyes, the bloody noses. Like, it was horrific the way these kids were beaten. And that was my last straw, hearing about those beatings. I was still so mind fucked that I didn't realize it was Nityananda who gave the instruction for that. And so I thought maybe Maud Bate had gone crazy and that she had tortured all of these kids.
How many kids was it again?
About 100.
Shit.
A lot of them are Americans.
Are they still there or did they get out?
Most of them are still there.
My God.
I've had two parents reach out to me and send me pictures of their kids and say it's thanks to your videos that these kids are not in that gurukul today. Two. Out of maybe 50 who had gurukul kids.
That's heartbreaking.
It was really, really harsh.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org. You did mention in the doc that he did pursue things with you sexually.
Oh, yeah. So he tried to, I won't say tried, he successfully entrapped me in his sexual web in 2016. And so I had started following him in 2009. There was not even a hint of sexuality until 2016. So I was fully brainwashed and wouldn't have believed that he was a sexual predator. Because I thought, well, if he was like that, why has he never tried anything with me? He must be innocent.
I used to say the same thing.
Yeah, I think he does this on purpose. He'll deliberately wait with certain people so that they have like plausible deniability. And that's part of the way he's coasted with all his accusations is that there will be like 15 to 20 gung-ho inner circle people saying nothing like that ever happened. And I would know because I'm right there with him. They don't know. Because they're not with him 24/7 like Ranjita is. I think she's the only one who would know everything. But yet, it started with Facebook Messenger messages where he told me, you are my Shakti, you are my Devi, you're the only one who understands me, I'm your Shiva. We can't tell anybody about this, dear, because they're not ready to accept an incarnated goddess, only their Shiva. And so he kind of made me feel like it was my mission to win over everybody else. He said, if you establish your social media team so that it's the biggest team in the Audinam, then we can join together as a divine couple. And I didn't realize he was saying the same thing to at least 100 other girls and a bunch of guys, too.
That's consistent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He would call me to press his feet, the way Jordan described in the docuseries. I think because that docuseries was made for an Indian audience, they used Jordan's abuse story and not also mine, because it's very hard for Indian people to hear about a woman getting sexually abused. Like, it's a cultural sore spot for them. But something very similar to what happened to Jordan happened to me.
Okay.
But no, I went to press his feet. And the first time I went to give him this foot massage, I believed that he was beyond gender, beyond sex, beyond any kind of human lust. And at one point, his hand kind of moved towards my chest. And he didn't grope or fondle. It's like the back of his knuckles were brushing against my breasts. So I moved back and kept pressing his feet, and I kept kind of distancing myself from him because his eyes were closed. So I thought he's not aware of where his hands are. Like I was so ready to defend him that I didn't even think he was doing that deliberately. And then later that night, he sent me a text message and said, "You missed a big opportunity. Why did you pull away from me?" And it was like, that was like my first holy shit moment where I realized he wasn't like in samadhi and like restful awareness accidentally touching me. Mm. He was trying to start something.
Wow.
It accelerated. Like thank God the extent of my abuse only went as far as like a couple of hand jobs. Like I didn't have to do the same disgusting work that his SM team had to do.
When you had those advances happen, how did that make you reconsider the stuff you had heard before?
It didn't, because I had never listened to Arti Rao's interview.
Oh, I see.
I had never watched the sex tape with Ranjita. I think I was very supremely innocent in that when he told me I was his incarnated Shakti, I actually thought, well, that's how I know the Ranjita video's fake. Because if he's Shiva and I'm Shakti, he wouldn't be messing around with a human woman. So she must really be just his administrative head and his personal secretary. And his abuse towards me made me justify even more, like, the lack of credibility for the other accusations against him.
Because you were the Shakti.
What broke that delusion was one day he sent me a text, like a Facebook Messenger message. He sent like a still from a porn sex scene of a threesome. Like there was this dude laying on a bed and two women were going at it. And he said, "Is this one of your fantasies?" And I replied back and said, "No, like it's not." And he said, "So it's not your fantasy, but would you be willing to do it?" And I replied back, like, "I'm a sannyasi. I'm in the orange kavi," which is like a sign of renunciation in Hinduism. And so that was a total shock. Like you don't expect your guru to send you porn and ask you if you'd be willing to do it. So I replied back, "No, I'm straight. I've never been attracted to other women. I'm not experimental like that. I've taken the vow of celibacy. So that's not my motivation in life." And then he kept pushing it and said, "Well, what if it would lead you to your enlightenment? Then would you do it?" And I said, "Well, then, yeah, I guess so, because it would be a tapas. Like it would be a sacrifice, but yeah." The next day, he called me to press his feet and he told me, "Start looking around and pick another woman." So it escalated fast.
This fucking guy, Jesus.
Yep. And he said, she can't be married and she can't be a sannyasi. So it's basically like, pick a victim. I had the audacity to ask him, "If I'm Shakti and you're Shiva, why do you want to bring a human woman into the mix? Isn't that like your child? Because Shiva is the father of humanity. Why would you be lusting after one of your own children?" And that day, I got kicked out of his so-called palace, like the apartment block sectioned off for him and his inner circle people. He sent me to stay in the public dorm, which was a huge downgrade. So I lost my AC and my hot water shower. I'm living now among
the common people.
The common people. Yeah. My friends, I don't even want to say common people because I loved all of those people.
I know. I'm teasing. Yeah.
It was a much less comfortable, like now I had to eat the rice and sambar instead of like the gourmet food that was served in his palace. And he told everybody that he had sent me out because I had become arrogant and that I was trying to keep him away from connecting to other females because of my jealousy. I was forbidden to tell anybody. Like we were told the moment he sent us a message in Facebook Messenger, we were told delete it. Read it, then delete it. So my biggest regret is that I have no evidence to these texts because he made us delete them as soon as he sent them. Like one of the lies that they tell people in his cult to discredit me is that I was an implant, that I was like a Catholic missionary sent to destroy Hinduism. And what I want to say is if I was an implant, I wouldn't have deleted all the messages he sent me. I would have saved them for evidence. The room where he had me stay, it was the room of his legal head. So I slept among boxes of all of his lawsuit paperwork over the years. I never opened a single box. Like, had I known then what I know now, I would have downloaded a scanner app on my phone and saved all that shit, but I didn't.
You're not going to get logical debates out of anyone who doesn't want to see the truth, so there's no point.
You can't.
Yeah.
Let's tie a few loose ends up. So you had a couple things that were heavy on the shelf. And then how did you actually escape?
I escaped because in Toronto, the house where we were staying was only a small handful of sannyasis. Like I was one of four people in the orange cavi. There were three ladies there who were not wearing cavi, not fully surrendered. And the lady who was there with me when the kids told me about the beatings, at that time, she was right there with me that this is wrong. This can never happen again. We have to leave. This is a cult. Mm-hmm. And I told her about all the sexual abuse stuff and she was shocked. And so she helped me get away. Like, we planned it out together that one morning when everyone else went to the Toronto temple, I would stay back and tell them that I'm not feeling well, pack my suitcase, go to the airport, fly to Calgary, arrange with my mom to pick me up and be out. So that was my escape. I snuck out when the house was empty, went to the airport, took off the cavi, put on like jeans and a t-shirt, and I was done.
Wow.
It took me about 6 months to deprogram. Like, I still believed it's a cult. The people are bad, but Swamiji might really be an incarnation. And I was gaslighting myself saying, but what if I am an incarnation of Devi? What if that was to break my patterns? So I did a lot of back and forth.
Mm-hmm. How did you deprogram? Did you get therapy or did you read or what was your healing?
Yeah, my healing, I became obsessed with cults. Like, I watched every episode of Scientology in the aftermath. And I was following the NXIVM case. You had done your New York Times article, but it was before any of the docuseries had come out. Right. But I was watching that whole case, taking notes like, okay, this is how they're exposing that psychopath. Like, maybe one day we can do the same for our psychopath. Mm-hmm. But I was also very isolated. In the years after Arti Rao went public, 9 years went by that not a single person ever spoke out.
It's crazy.
And I didn't know anybody else. The lady who had initially helped me escape went full on back in.
Oh, wow.
Started working as part of the Gurukul admin team.
What?
No way.
When I finally went public a year after escaping the cult, in the very first video that I made about the brainwashing and the child abuse, I gave a public apology to Arti Rao, Lenin Karupan, and Vinay Bharadwaj, who were the three whistleblowers everybody ignored in 2010. And I told them, now I know you were telling the truth. I didn't see it then, but I see it now. And I'll take this up as my personal mission to pick it up where you left, because they had all stopped speaking to the media like 5 years ago. And I felt personally responsible, having been his top recruiter, that a lot of the people suffering there, it's because of my YouTube videos. So it's kind of like, I made this mess, now I have to clean it up.
Yep.
Right.
And they launched a character assassination the day after I spoke up publicly, where they falsely accused me of raping two kids. They falsely accused me of poisoning the guru. They said that he had to flee India because I was an assassin and poisoned him. They filed a police report to the Ramanagara police that I had poisoned him and should be charged with, I think they said, like, treason, like a crazy, nonsensical kind of a charge. So I can never go to India because I'll be charged with raping kids and poisoning this fraud cult leader and possibly treason, which I still don't understand that charge.
Do you even want to go back to India? I mean,
it's a beautiful place. Yeah. Like, I have no problem with the Indian people, just with this one cult.
Yes, of course.
They told their followers that I was a demon. Like, at that time, there was this viral suicide thing online where people would get sucked in and do challenges that led to suicide. And he had taken my photo and morphed it with like the monster that appears in that and said, she's the one who created this and it's her goal to make people kill themselves. And if you listen to Sarah Landry's videos, she will destroy your spiritual connection. You'll lose your liberation. And so the way we had all been scared in the early days that we will never watch the Ranjita video, he scared his disciples so they'll never watch my YouTube videos. I think the best thing that I've had happen since then is that a few Gurukul kids have reached out to me and told me that when that happened, the kids overheard the grownups talking that, you know, Sarah Landry says that kids were beaten. Can you believe it? She's such a liar. What a bitch. Why would she say this? And so the kids had kind of banded together. And whenever they could get their hands on a device, they would walk out to an area in the auditorium where there was no supervision. And they started watching my videos.
Oh.
And the kids told me for them, it was so good to know that there was an adult who was on their side, who didn't want them to get beaten and tortured.
Ugh.
So that made it all worth it for me. I hate the fact that their parents are unwilling to believe that it happened. Like, there's so much cognitive dissonance,
right?
Yep.
Where anything the guru does has to be good because it's coming from him. Anything a whistleblower says has to be wrong because it's against him. There's no logic involved. It's black or white, good or bad. He's good, we're bad, in their minds.
You're not going to get a civil discourse.
They won't wake up until they have their own moment of clarity like you had, when they can see something that affects them in that way. Until then, all the terrible things that are said about him must be lies because he's good.
Exactly.
And some of them may even think that, you know, that the beating needed to happen for the reasons that they said the beatings needed to happen. And actually, the person in the Vice documentary who was blurred out, who was anonymous, said something that really struck a chord in me. She said that, like, even at the time, she knew that the whistleblowing that Artira was saying was true because she'd experienced it as well. But the way that it was being exposed wasn't right. And the way that it was being brought to the world was wrong. And so she stayed. That happened with us too. There were a lot of people who said they came to terms with, like, what Keith did was bad, but the fact that we were public about it and that we, you know, went to the media was unethical and that it should have been handled internally. And it's just such a strategy to deflect bad action and immoral activity from all of these leaders. Actually, Keith taught us, it's called the shifter strategy, to shift the attention over here while you can do these other things. Hey, A Little Bit Culty listeners. Bless your little bitty hearts for helping support this podcast. You asked us to put a link up where you could make a one-time or monthly contributions to help us cover the costs of taking this podcast from our living room to your earbuds. And so we did. And wow, you weren't kidding around when you said you wanted to help this podcast keep on cranking out episodes. You stepped up. Thank you. In fact, in a relatively short time, 70 of you have already chipped in. And together, the whole beautiful lot of you have covered the cost of making almost 5 full A Little Bit Culty episodes. That's pretty freaking good. You are amazing. Did you know that? And yes, we're talking to you, Veronica Wells, Annie Blake, Thomas Wicks, and John Breen, and you, Kenny Bernstein, and Kristen O'Rourke. You rule, Sarah Priestley and Roger Seidman, and you are rad. Andrea Padillas, Helena Durst, Sally Lotz, Joel Blair, and Jolene Bishop. That's just a few of you who are helping to make this podcast happen. Want to make a contribution? Just go to alittlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio. Every little bit helps keep A Little Bit Culty trucking along. Thanks again. We adore you.
Well, and you know how earlier you were saying that, like, Keith and Nityananda and all of them will say, if you listen to something that disturbs your ideal of the guru, it will forever impact your connection. Like, that will color your perception of that person if you hear something bad about them. And I feel like that's why Scientology came up with fair game. And that's why all of these cult leaders use that strategy. If a whistleblower comes out and says kids got beaten, they can't just go public and say, no, the kids never got beaten. This is a lie. And here's our proof.
No, they have to attack your character.
They have to attack our character. And so they're aware of the fact that if people Google me now, they'll come up to, you know, videos made of people crying, saying she raped me and she's a sex addict and she kept me as a sex slave. And, you know, it's ridiculous what they've said about me. You know, the first person who interviewed me after I came out was the late Ron Miscavige. And that was, I think, the beginning of my healing because we had a Skype call before the interview and I started to cry and I told him, I don't think you should interview me because they're calling me a rapist, a white supremacist, an assassin. And if you interview me, they'll start attacking you. And he just laughed and sent me the links to all the websites Scientology had created against him and said, no, I know you're telling the truth because they're doing all of that.
Right.
The day after the first episode of that interview got published on his YouTube channel, Nityananda gave a discourse about how great Scientology is, that L. Ron Hubbard was a modern day Rishi, that society doesn't understand him, but he's done such a great contribution to humanity.
Read the room, bozo.
I know he has no idea.
So where are we now with, you know,
he's on an island?
He claims that.
How is he getting away with it? Why hasn't law enforcement gotten him? Who's supporting him?
Yeah, what's the status?
The status as of now is pending. It's like I feel like there's a little loading icon on the story of his of his life because he's been in hiding for like 2 years now. He claims that he's created his own nation state called Kailasa. And one really unfortunate thing is that he has support from a lot of international governments who are helping him
right.
through his bribery. And one of the things that he did to try to get help in his plea is he built up a whole grand narrative about his life where he claims to be the head of all Hinduism. The leader of 2 billion Hindus worldwide. He claims to be like the highest person in the Hindu hierarchy and say that he is a persecuted minority, that his organization is upholding one of the traditions of India that's being attacked by anti-Hindus and racists and people who are trying to commit a cultural genocide. So he has had a lot of his close disciples, including girls in the Gurukul and women who are brahmacharinis, he has had them fabricate elaborate rape stories against anybody who has spoken out. So journalists, for example, the journalist who tried to give him the court summons.
Oh, he was so badass. I loved him, by the way. He was great.
Me too. Yeah. So he's been falsely accused of rape by one of Nityananda's disciples. Lenin has been falsely accused of rape and actually got arrested because of a lie of one of the disciples. I've been falsely accused of rape. They've collected all of these fake rape stories and put them together in a document showing that they are a persecuted indigenous minority group. And they've presented that to the UNHCR and they've gotten acknowledgement for it. They've given talks at human rights seminars painting themselves as victims of this racist anti-Hindu attack that they claim I'm leading.
What the fuck?
The accusations against me are ridiculous. They posted on Twitter 2 days ago saying that I personally committed cultural genocide against the First Nations people of Canada and buried kids in mass unmarked graves at schools that I ran. Ugh. So they're trying to pin the residential school atrocities on me. And when I replied to that thread and said, this is so ridiculous, I'm glad you said this because this shows how crazy you are. Now they claim, oh, it wasn't me, but it was my family. And it's like, dude, my ancestors were Mennonites. They're like a pacifist. That's a whole other cult, I think, but they were not.
They didn't do that.
Twitter wars.
Nippy is a great quote about Twitter, which I rarely look at because it's just so gross. But what do you call it, Nippy?
It's the bathroom wall of social media.
Oh my God, I love it.
Just don't it even is. Look. I just don't look. No. I mean, otherwise they take up too much space in your mind. You know, I hope it doesn't bother you too much.
Also, Twitter wars, it's, you know, who looks at that? And what happens if you win on Twitter? What do you win?
Nothing. What happens? Nothing happens.
Yeah.
I like that Twitter gives us an outlet to, like, a lot of Nityananda survivors who are scared to go public because they don't want the character assassination or to die mysteriously like a lot of people who left him did, or to be charged with rape by a lying disciple. So they go to Twitter with anonymous accounts and go into details about things they witnessed and experienced, but with that safety of anonymity. So I like that. I like that it gives us that platform.
You can make it positive.
What do you want people to know? Was there anything missing that's super important from the Vice documentary that you feel needs to be shared?
What's missing from the Vice documentary is everything that's happened in Nityananda's cult since he fled India, other than the sensationalist story that he established his own country. And what I mean by that is the human trafficking. Like, a lot of people who signed on to live in his Adinam have been told to fly to random countries, some in South America, some in Africa, with the instruction, don't tell anybody where you're going. Don't look in the suitcase that we're giving you to carry. Go meet with this person and that government. Give them this money that we're handing to you. So there's money laundering. There's human trafficking, both labor trafficked and sex trafficked disciples of his. They should have included Ranjita in that docuseries. I didn't appreciate the fact that they didn't use her name and that they blurred her face and they made it seem almost like, you know, this poor woman has been shown in a compromising position on the media, but she's not one of his victims. She's one of his enablers. She's his right-hand person.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like to understand the sinister nature of Nityananda, people also need to understand the sinister nature of Ranjita because they are a pair in their crimes.
Yeah.
She trains his victims to serve him sexually. She gaslights his victims to blame themselves for things that he does that hurt them. I've actually heard some victims who survived that cult say that Nityananda was nice before Ranjita entered his life. And I don't think so. I think he was always a predator.
Yeah, that's part of the con. And if she admits abuse is going on, she has to admit that she's been abused and she's not willing to do that.
Yeah, and she's not willing to do that, but also she knows that she will go to prison as well for the crimes she committed. She's right. abused people. She's slapped people. She's beaten people. She's instructed people to beat each other.
There you go.
There are quite a few people who I think need to go to prison along with Nityananda. And she's the top of that list. And I think Vice got too scared of the fact that Ranjita has sued Indian media for showing the sex tape.
I was going to bring that up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think they decided to just avoid that whole can of worms and leave her out of it. But I think the public needs to know she is not a victim here. She's one of the abusers with him.
That's very cowardly of Vice, I got to say. Like that's like.
Yeah. Well, that's what allows this stuff to permeate. Cowardice at the top of leadership. Hierarchies. It's going on in all the extreme systems right now. People are too afraid to stand up for it because they don't want to inconvenience their comforts and their lifestyles to do what's right.
And that's what's different about you, Sarah. Like the fact that you're still talking about this and you didn't just escape and move
good
on with
for
your life.
Sarah.
Yeah, seriously, good for you.
Thank you. That means a lot, especially coming from you two who are doing as much as you've done.
Well, we know it's not easy and it takes a huge drain on your life force. And but I also know, or I project anyway, that as a former recruiter and advocate for our guru, that you got to make it right, you know, and that's part of the healing journey for sure.
We'll certainly be following this and, you know, hopefully justice happens soon. And when it does, we'll have you back on and hopefully celebrate.
Yeah. I look forward to that.
Sarah and I were talking before the podcast. When someone starts to kind of put out that negative force, whatever you want to call it, you know, that he's doing, it immediately puts into motion its demise and for the good to come. It's only a matter of time. I'm confident in that. Hope that happens soon.
And when that happens, we'll do like an Instagram live update
for
our audience.
Hells yes. Yeah.
That'll be great. Yeah. Oh. Were we going to do what chaps my ass?
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, yes. Yeah. Thank you.
What
chaps your ass?
I talked this through with all the other victims who are all anonymous in our chat groups. And one of them said, oh, I listened to that podcast. And my auntie Mary Lynn told me to tell you both that it's her favorite podcast.
Oh,
and
hi, Mary Lynn.
Thanks, Mary Lynn.
She's going to freak out when she hears that. Like she listens to your song. The song at the beginning of your podcast. Yeah. And like, that's even like her favorite song now.
Oh, by John Bryant. Yeah. So we love that song too. So what was the chaps?
What chaps my ass is that from the time Arti and Lenin went public, they went to the police for help and said he's a sexual predator and that he's raped and molested 30 to 40 men and women, even back then in 2010. And nothing was done about it. And there was a bit of a media circus in India, and then life went on. And then when I went public, I sent a police complaint to the Department in India for Protection of Women and Children, to the Bidadi police, and to the Ramanagara police, and I forwarded a copy to Interpol, and nothing was done. And we've sent tips to the FBI about his money laundering. His entire financial base is in the United States. And so we've sent all kinds of tips to all kinds of different police. And he's allowed to keep raping people, silencing people, putting false accusations. So what chaps my ass is that he is a monster out there in the world destroying people's lives. And the UN seems to be supporting him while he continues to brainwash people, use people for money, use people for sex service, and bully and intimidate his victims into silence. That's what chaps my ass.
That chaps my ass too. It's so consistent with these guys because it sounds like he's probably bribing and buying off certain people that can keep him in a position of power.
Also, he has misinformation on his side. So I don't know necessarily with those agencies, but it allows him a certain currency to get away because he's a guru. And
we'll see if there's anything we can do on our end with our contacts.
Yes.
The presentation that he gives to the UN, it includes letters from heads of state in the US, congressmen, mayors, and they've all signed off on it saying that some of their constituents have really benefited from this guru, so please protect him. And the top letter on his stack of letters is a beautiful, glowing recommendation by Susan Sarandon. And so they've swindled a lot of people by saying, well, look, an Oscar-winning actress is supporting him.
Have you reached out to her?
I've tried. I've tweeted at her, but I don't think she saw my messages.
You might have to go through her manager.
If we've learned anything, when an actor endorses someone, it might be a red flag.
Yeah, true.
We also know it's possible to like attend a retreat and be like, wow, this is amazing, and then endorse it, as was the case in, for us many times.
For sure. He could never get the Dalai Lama the way Keith did.
Right. Yeah. Listen, let's keep in touch. Let us know how we can help.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anytime.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like is offered purely as commentary, because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you.
Okay, Nippy, hit me up with some Nitenyanda word salad.
Okay, this is the word salad. I took it straight from the dot because it was so good or bad. Me is only sitting as me and you. This too is only talking to each other. Understand, I can only talk to me and give my understanding. I cannot talk to anybody else and give my understanding. So the me resides in this as me is residing in all of that as me. So the me through this me talking to me.
And the dude just stares at the crowd like
he said something that meant something. But it's like powerful. And I thought one of the coolest things about that doc, at first I was kind of like, I can't really understand how the India media portrays it. It was confusing. But then to see how the media and how they digest their content and the idiosyncrasies of their culture, I thought ended up being one of the cooler aspects of that doc.
Absolutely.
Because you can see the pattern and just how they're susceptible in ways that you and I aren't and vice versa.
And yet the template's once again, exactly the same.
Me residing in me as me.
What does that mean?
Well, that's the thing. You make something out of it and you think it's him.
Yeah.
Right? That's the nature of word salad. Anyway, I hope you guys learned. Hope it was informative.
Yeah. Hope you learned. I hope you have a fabulous summer. Stay tuned for those bonus episodes and we'll see you in the fall for season 5 of A Little Bit Culty. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean.
Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, like take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. Takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.